I didn't know anything about this industry. I was supposed to be a lawyer because my parents were lawyers. And I went to college and I studied English and really got actually into literary theory, which was almost the philosophy of language. What does the word meaning mean? And why is there a word for nothing if nothing doesn't exist, but you have a word for it, then it does exist. And so I wrote a whole thesis on that.
Welcome to Passion to Power with your host, Michelle Zeitlin. She's a creative producer who quote-unquote wears many hats. She's also a talent and literary manager and founded the company Morzap Productions and Management. She develops people and projects across all media. Her guests encompass the gamut, from artists to authors, actors to activists, programming executives, development executives, and A&R. Michelle Zeitlin is excited to share her tips and tools for success through her conversations mostly via Zoom during quarantine. Please welcome Michelle Zeitlin, Passion to Power.
I first met Jonas Agin when he was a new hire at Disney, and I had a client on camera named Kelly Berglund. She was working on a series that was being developed by two writers that came over from primetime television, Chris Peterson and Brian Moore, with their showrunner Mark Brazil. They all came over from That 70s Show and created Lab Rats for Disney XD. Now, Jonas Agin is a big shot. Jonas Agin pronounced his name three different ways, but we got the Disney read. It was totally on brand.
Okay. Jonas Agin. Jonas Agin. Jonas Agin.
Oh, that was the Disney one.
Knew I had to go up. The Disney Channel focus for live action, which is what I do, has been typically 6 to 11, maybe 6 to 14 kids. As we started to make some more stuff for Disney Plus, the first thing out we made was called High School Musical, the Musical, the Series, which started as a joke pitch of a title. And then we're like, you know, and somebody said, what's that about? We're like, it's about a high school, you know, that they put on High School Musical for their High School Musical. And we're like, maybe there's a show there. And that
I have a friend on the show. He actually had a podcast too with my friend Rebecca Galarza. He plays the gay kid, the gay Hispanic kid.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's he's fantastic. Yeah,
he is fantastic.
He's fantastic. That was the target for that initially was for people who grew up on High School Musical. So it was more of a millennial target. And we get some when we tested it though. It really tested high in the sort of 9 to 17 bracket, or maybe 12 to 17. So we realized that for Plus, especially appropriating that IP, we could sort of go a little bit older. As of November, when there was a whole shift at the Walt Disney Company, where it sort of was, the media was broken into two segments, the distribution segment and the content creation segment. My job as VP of development is sort of twofold, where we will still develop original projects for both Disney Channel Linear that then will migrate to Plus, as well as Disney Plus Originals that focus on probably kids, teens, and family is the best way to put it, making sure it's not just a one quadrant audience. We also function because we're now called Disney branded television. So I no longer work for Disney Channel. I oversee original series for Disney branded television, is we work with our partners on the studio side at 20th and ABC Signature on the projects that they have that they're developing for the platform to sort of help them calibrate and navigate to see what seems to be most brand appropriate or most appropriate for what it seems like the consensus is for the Disney Plus next iteration of shows.
That was very good. You summarized that very well. Let's back up. I actually learned about what quadrant meant on a recent podcast with someone you probably know, Mike Young, who is the founder of Splash Entertainment, Kabillion. And he was talking about his four quadrant audiences for his animated movies with a very, you know, lovely Welsh accent. So now I know your quadrant is sort of your demo, right?
Yep.
So you were at Disney Channel when I met you, which was right around the time Kelly Berglund was about 14, 15 and auditioning early in the early stages of Lab Rats. Isn't that about when you came in?
I did. First of all, I apologize if you could hear now what sounds like somebody cutting somebody's lawn.
That's right.
It was about 10 years ago when I actually came in doing global programming at the channel, which meant I worked with all of our international partners on their productions to sort of make sure it was aligned brand-wise with the type of stuff we were doing so that their local shows felt Disney Channel. As part of that remit, I also was tasked with overseeing some original shows domestically, especially for Disney XD, and Lab Rats was the first show that I worked on as a development exec at the organization.
Now Brian and Chris, Brian Moore and Chris Peterson have a new show.
They do. You know, I love those guys. They were great partners. It was great to see them go from, you know, they didn't actually run the first season of the show, but they took the reins on afterwards.
It was Mark Brazil that got brought in, right, for show running?
It was. Mark worked with them on that 70s show. So they had a relationship with Mark.
I've been following his Instagrams. I like his point of view.
He always has a very strong point of view. And he has some insane stories. He's worth a podcast just to hear the anecdotes of his life. Fill up a couple hours.
But let him know I'll be calling. Yeah,
I will. But he loves to talk about himself as we all do. So he's. I promise you, he says yes. I'll speak.
I'd like to hear Mark Brazil interview Howard Stern.
You could be the moderator.
I'll do the cabbage patch.
Absolutely. This could be like a second podcast where you just bring in certain people.
I'll just curate.
So Chris and Brian, they ran that show. They did a great job with that show. It was a huge hit on Disney XD, but it was also one of the shows that we played a lot on Disney Channel. And it really had sort of kid appeal, not just girl, not boy, but it sort of gender neutrality. They were able to sort of set up these somewhat serialized arcs so that there would be tentpole episodes, but it was still an episodic, close-ended episode comedy that ran for, I don't know if it was four seasons or what. There was a spinoff where it sort of Mighty Med and Lab Rats kind of came together for its last season that Chris and Brian ran. We tried a few things with them actually over the years. Nothing quite got there to get made. And this project they're working on now, it just goes to show you that when you do believe in people, it's sort of the right people with the right idea at the right time.
Yeah, it sounds like a sumo wrestler just landed on your ceiling. I heard some wrestling or
something. It's probably my son.
Did he win? Did he take her down, your sister, your daughter?
Well, she's in Zoom school right now.
Oh, okay.
In class, let's see. Yeah, she should be in social studies right now. son, who has only, he's four, so he has two Zoom classes, a half hour each a day, is either wrestling our dog.
That's what I heard.
Hard to say who's going to win in that one.
Yeah. Well, my son's wrestling calculus, so. What do you think has been your biggest learning curve? That's my first question. And if you could tomorrow switch gears, where would you go?
Biggest learning curve for sure is executive management. You know, I came into when I was overseeing development for Disney XD, I think I had two direct reports. And then when I first came onto Disney Channel, we were actually much larger. It was something like 7 or 8 direct reports. And I generally want people to like me. And so it was harder for me to be honest and critical in real time. I sort of allowed empathy to be such the driver, not realizing that you could be empathetic, but also critical. And I think what it unfortunately allowed me to do is be preferential towards certain projects or certain executives. And it was a real conscious effort to myself to say, everybody deserves to have the shot to grow and to prove their career trajectory is upwards. And I shouldn't be the reason that that's not afforded to them. In fact, my job is to afford that to them. And so I got better, I think, with being just more open and honest and transparent with my team members about if they did something that I thought, I'm not sure if you should have done that, say that right then. Or to make sure that I really pointed out the wins to them. Like, I thought that was a fantastic way you conducted that phone call. And then to just have general conversations about how they felt they were doing and how I felt they were doing. So that was the biggest learning curve for me, was how to be a manager, for sure. What would I do if I could just change paths? Well, if I didn't have to worry about money, I would be a professor of some, whether of writing or something that has to do with television, and maybe write a novel, which I have a few ideas for, but too afraid either to execute or tell myself I don't have enough time. But I do love the academic space. I do love the idea of just being able to talk about the process. I do love the idea of, even when I've worked with younger writers, to help elevate their material through experience and just my own sort of learnings and point of view.
So my show is called Passion to Power, and it's really about harnessing the passion, which initially is going to give you that strength and direction, and then getting to the power, which is, you know, where you really find your vision, your calling. What would you say is the passion for you in your work, and how has it made you more powerful?
Well, the passion definitely comes through generally certain projects. I feel that there's certain projects that just I can get excited about. And again, my general propensities are, I love creative risk. They sort of say, all other risk makes me anxious and unsure and want to crawl into a hole, but creative risk really charges me. Again, if people are like, I don't know if we could do that, I don't know if people will like that, to me, that's a calling card for like, so for sure we have to do it. Maybe too much so. And I think that has given me the power when we pulled something off, or, oh my God, this pilot was our highest testing and we never thought that this could work. I'm so right, but a little bit of the validation of, if you really believe in something, and if there's an idea for a show or a concept or a character that I sort of said, when you have shows that you forget you're getting paid for your job for, the rest of the stuff is what you're getting paid for. But when you're like, it's 3 a.m. and I woke up and I'm gonna send a text or an email, like, what about this? Or here's another approach of an idea we could put to this. And it's really just about the creative. It's not about, oh my God, is somebody going to like this? Am I gonna keep my job? It's just pure. That's where the personal fulfillment comes. And I think also the professional growth comes in that. And it's being able to let go of the voice inside that says, I'm not sure, or maybe quiet that down, or, but what if it fails? And to sort of embrace, you know, so I always say, if we're gonna fail, let's just fail big. Like, let's just completely flame out and scorch the earth, because the worst type of failure is like, we were playing it safe and it didn't work. Like, there's, anybody can play it safe. And again, we're in entertainment. A lot of times it's not gonna work. So have it not work, but be something you could walk away from and be like, I'm thrilled I got to do that. And there's definitely a few projects I've done where that has happened as well.
Can you flame out and scorch the earth in Disney though? I mean, it seems such a formatted company.
You can. I mean, you know, there's been some projects that I will still say, oh, I'm so thrilled that Gary let me do that, right? That like, it didn't test well, and maybe it didn't come out the way I saw, but from a concept level or the writer, it was like, there is something here. And I still will stand by some of those projects to this day to be like, there's value in that. Even though everybody who saw it told us like, well, you just spent $3 million for no reason. Probably not 3 million, but whatever the money was less. Again, Disney is definitely, there is a sort of a standard and a model. I think for Disney to stay relevant and contemporary, part of what we're all trying to do just company-wide is figure out how elastic can we be? What is the evolution of the brand? How do you keep what is inherent to Disney, which a lot is hopefulness and magic and the indomitability of the human spirit, fantasy, emotion, human connection, music. And how can you take those tentacles and spread them as far as possible to still come out the other side with sort of a notion of hope and optimism? when we buy, when we put something into development, the math of it is that 90% it won't go to pilot. That's just the chances, right? So inherent in the job is, if you want to see it this way, is failure, or is, you know, netting zero. And sometimes we'll shoot pilots that we all think will be great and they aren't. Sometimes we'll shoot pilots and we're not quite sure and they test through the roof. And then of course we retroactively look back, we're like, no, of course we were brilliant. We just were questioning ourselves. It was the imposter syndrome. We knew we should have known all along that this was the greatest show ever.
So I have a big question. So how, can you be an individual when you're working for Disney? Can you have your own opinion in the cosmos of being a representative of Disney and the Disney world?
Yeah, certainly. Anybody can be anything, right? I mean, it's how much do you decide to talk out of school, I guess, or how much do you wear your sort of feelings on your sleeve? And that probably depends on the individual. I would say, you know, Disney itself is trying to be a place that is more inclusive and representational, as sort of Hollywood is having this conversation overall about, you know, the idea of, if you really want mass appeal, you have to appeal to the masses, and the masses aren't just one thing. It is just a cross section of diversity and all different walks of life and all different ways of perceiving the world. And if you don't let them know you're talking to them specifically, then they may feel you're intentionally not talking to them specifically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's hallmarks of storytelling at Disney where we can't touch upon certain things that are too PG-13 or rated R, or stuff that, you know, that I would watch, but that, you know, it's good having kids. So I'm like, I don't want my kids hearing this conversation yet or seeing this scene yet. But I think as executives at Disney, there's not much preclusion about point of view or ideology. It really is more just about the standards and practices of what feels appropriate or not for certain Disney branded content to take on.
I've got a few friends. Do you know Fonda Snyder by any chance? She's a good friend. She worked for herself kind of also in the children's book world, Storyopolis, and then Alchemy, developing books to screen. And now she's working for Batad Entertainment. And it's very much about creating toys that kids can express life through, right? Their experience. It's sort of what the idea is like behind Mattel and Hasbro. So how much is that thought process ingrained in you guys as a team? Like when you're creating content, do you also think about the evolution of the kid and how that will be a toy, or how the toy eventually will become part of the project, the content?
We're always mindful about franchise potential, sort of put it that way. And so if there seems to be something within the DNA of a show that seems like, oh my God, this can become consumer products in some way, whether that's clothing, action figures, whatever it is, we have a sort of a brand group that we'll go to and be like, hey, read the script. Do you think that there's life beyond the screen for this project? And then we'll discuss what that may be. So yeah, we're mindful of it. I think we never try to force it into something, right? It's never like, God, if there was only a play pattern in this show, what could that be? It's more like, oh, this show sort of seems to lend itself to a play pattern. Let's see if we can make that happen, because obviously anything that lives off the screen in your living room and sort of in a tactile form is just more engagement for the show and more engagement for the viewer to own it, which is important. It's tough to do that, I will say. I think in the preschool world, it's easier, because those kids play with toys. I think in the animated space, it's somewhat easier because it's evergreen, right? Those characters will always look the same. They'll naturally sort of reinvent themselves when they have to, but if not, the sameness of it becomes almost iconic. And I think in our space, it's really, you know, Hannah Montana predated me. Descendants is probably our biggest franchise now, which comes out of our DCOM group, Lauren Kozlowski.
Kenny, right? Kenny Ortega.
Kenny, yeah.
I go back with the dancer days of Kenny Ortega.
Yeah. Yeah, and he did High School Musical. I mean, that, you know,
I know.
Descendants was developed. He was sort of the first and only call. But that, everybody knew, like, oh, we're reappropriating sort of Disney IP, and we're talking about the kids of villains. So it, of course there's a play franchise-wise.
Right.
Of course there's a play thematically. It has to exist in its sort of just content form, right? The script itself has to hold up to say, we want to make this. It just so happened that baked into the DNA of that was a clear franchise potential.
Speaking of the important issues of today in a huge enterprise such as Disney, I thought that Brian and Chris, and I'm sure with the help of the whole team, really broke some models with the interracial relationship in Lab Rats. And, you know, also the idea of these powerful kids with technology. I mean, do you try to softly, I know, you know, certainly High School Musical has tried to do that too. How do you kind of integrate the issues of race and gender and politics for your audience, which is so young?
Well, I think we've become much more conscious of doing it, first of all, over the past year for sure, and maybe the past few years, which is realizing that our audience is much more aware than maybe previous audiences about these conversations and about social justice, about racial inequality, about LGBTQ issues. And that they're actually much more forgiving of just the content presentation. You know, we would sort of be so conservative, right? And that's part of their daily life. So it is, when meeting with showrunners and creators, just letting them know that we want to dive into those conversations, not shy away from them. Some shows are going to more inherently be about that because the creator will come from a point of view of saying, I want to tell this story, or this is the cultural specificity that is important to me to bring out. Other times, you know, when we find somebody in casting, you know, there's a show called Sydney to the Max I developed, and the lead is biracial. And the showrunner, Mark Reisman, is now really diving into stories about that. The show never was about that. And in fact, probably in the first season, never even touched upon. But I think it was the realization, and as he got to know Ruth more and realized there's so much conversation to be had, that the show can become about that. So it sort of depends at what point are the levers available to turn, and then it's our duty and the sort of the writer's duty to make sure that we turn them, that we remind each other of the importance of them being turned. But it's very conscious right now to make sure we're doing that.
So my next question in relation is, like your own kids and your wife, a lot of people are home.
Yep.
Viewing habits have changed.
Yep.
How much is that consciously coming up in conversation with your team?
It's coming up a lot. You know, at one point early on, you said, we're like a Nielsen ratings house. And it's like the thing, ratings generally are declining. They're so fragmented and fractured. Nobody watches TV on the same day. And maybe you'll get a Live+3, Live+7. You know, for such a long time, I tracked daily ratings for Disney Channel and then stopped because it's like, what's the point? It's not really a sign of affinity and engagement. I think on streaming platforms, the idea of serialization and cliffhangers and the need to go to the next one is just more inherent. Disney Plus still rolls things out weekly, right? You have to wait for the next week, which I think is a smart model. So you can either build them all up, or you could anticipate, oh my God, this just happened. What's the next week going to be like? I think from the linear side, at least for our audience on Disney Channel, because we have to fill 24 hours a day, it is more episodic. It is more like, oh, you find it and you could just jump right in. So I think the viewing habits are, again, it's not one or the other. There's the, let me just sort of lean back and see what's on. And like, I'll watch Seinfeld a million times, and our audience will watch Raven a million times. And then there is, what is the offering that may not repeat a ton, but will be leave a real mark and be the type of show that will hopefully lead to other types of shows that even if they have a singular or maybe the best a second engagement with that type of show, it's lasting, which I think, you know, we've seen really starting with the cable companies, HBO, and so, you know, the Sopranos and 6 Feet Under, into sort of the Netflix model of get them in the last 30 seconds to say, what the hell? And they'll come back.
As we wrap up, I want to thank Jonas Agin for offering his time and his talent and his expertise while juggling so much from home. We're all juggling so much during these remote days. And as we go into 2021 with lots of optimism, but not a lot of certainty, I just really appreciate the graciousness and kindness of people offering their expertise and their time. Jonas Agin wraps it up now with some great advice for you.
I would love for you to speak to that aspiring person that maybe is at UC Western or in studio school where Jeremy teaches, or UCLA or USC Film School. That person who's like, I'm going to go to school for 4 years and then I'm going to get a job in the industry. Tell me what you would like to say to that person, that aspiring person who has big eyes and full of aspiration and lots of motivation.
Number one, network. Call everybody who is an alumni from your school that you could find who works in this industry. Don't be afraid to put yourself out there. Don't be afraid to call them again. Your call won't always be returned, but whoever does return the call, keep them close, because you need advocates and you need mentors. And everybody will give you different advice and different points of view. Often they will contradict each other. It's only experience that will allow you to decide which of those points of view or advice sort of work for you. Be open to anything. Obviously, if you want to be a writer, that's fantastic, but be open to development. If you want to be in casting, that's great, but be open to being an agent. Try to get a job. Any job is the right job in this industry, and make sure that you are, again, talking to everybody you can, because it is about access points. Again, it is who you know, in the sense of the bigger your network is, the more opportunities you're going to have. Embrace everything with the enthusiasm that hopefully you have, and don't allow that enthusiasm. Don't be jaded for the sake of it. Go see theater in Los Angeles. A lot of people don't do that, but like, there's great theater that has great actors and great writers and directors, and those people may go on to being in television and film. Be nice to every assistant, because they are the ones who will become the next executives. And so if you're nice to them, they will remember that. If you do something, like if you're a writer, write every day, write when it's terrible. Also, if you're a writer, don't say, but I'm just not ready to share something yet. The job is to share something. Be vulnerable, be open to the fact that you will be criticized. Know that you're gonna make a ton of mistakes. Know that sometimes people are gonna yell at you for those mistakes, and sometimes people will be more empathetic, and no matter what, it's fine. And it is sort of about recognizing the resilience and the long game, that you could say like, it's been a year and I haven't grown to this level already, but so-and-so has. Stop positing yourself against others, right? Sort of the envy of your colleagues, or the schadenfreude of, oh, I got higher, is gonna bite you in the ass either way. So be as true to yourself and compassionate to yourself, but to all those around you as possible. And read, just because reading's good for you.
A good show for Freeform, Bite You in the Ass.
Bite You in the Ass, yep.
That's a great name. Okay, so now the pod that's growing on LinkedIn, the 42 to 60 analytic pod that's listening to this podcast, what would you like to say to the pivoters?
There's such a time of transition right now. We're all pivoting, right? This is the entertainment industry is going through a huge pivot. So to be part of that pivot and to accept it is necessary and unavoidable. And the idea of taking known what you've done before that has been true, and realizing that there's still going to be value to that, but recognizing also that inherently there's going to be difference in that, and trying to get ahead of the curve and trying to figure out, if you were to sort of look at the old job and say, if I was to do it today, I would make it look like this. It's having that point of view of, you can't resist the change, right? I always remember, like, when Napster came around, and like, we got rid of Napster, and it's like, and then obviously iTunes and everything else. If the record companies only knew that they should have had Geffen.com and Columbia.com and buy our songs from us, it would actually be the same model, right? It would be different distribution platforms, but the whole model was upended because people couldn't believe that the model would change. The model's changed. It already has changed. So see what it's changing towards, have a point of view of that, 1 foot tethered to the past, because people, it's hard to let go and there's truth in the past, and 1 foot stretching as far as possible into the future. And I think all for everybody, it's have a sense of humility, an acceptance of none of us really know what the right thing is. But if you're quiet and don't have a thought about the right thing, then it's the wrong thing.
Love that. So last question, Jonas, could you tell me what you would say to yourself now, your 18 to 20 year old self?
Congrats, you didn't have to go to law school.
That's great. All right, well, thank you so much, Jonas. Is there anything that you want to add that maybe I didn't touch on?
No, this has been comprehensive. It's been great to see you. And really, I think the last time we saw each other was the lobby of the Disney Channel building.
It was, you remember, yeah.
So I'm glad we got to reconnect. Congrats on everything that you've been doing. And hopefully it won't be another decade before we talk again. But thanks for the time and the great questions.
Yay!